Welcome to the Alliance Party After Dark, a podcast for the politically aware, brought to you by the Alliance Party. This podcast was recorded on September 5th, 2019. My name is M. Lloyd Johnson, moderator of the Alliance Party After Dark, and this episode is the second in a four-part series, where we hear from the national chair of the Alliance Party, Mr. Jim Rex. Jim has a solid background in politics. He co-founded and chaired the American Party of South Carolina, and he was the last Democrat to win a statewide election in South Carolina when elected as the 16th State Superintendent of Education in 2006. Education is a big part of Jim's life. He earned a PhD in curriculum and instruction from the University of Toledo. Though he began his career as a high school English teacher and football coach, he soon worked his way up to become the Dean of Education at Winthrop University and at Coastal Carolina University. And later, he served as president of Columbia College in South Carolina. We had so many questions for Jim, and our discussion lasted nearly 2 hours, so we broke everything up into four episodes of about a half hour each. You're listening to the second of the series. In the first installment of this series, we talked about a variety of topics, including unemployment, the economy, healthcare, and immigration. We'll continue now, starting out with a discussion of terrorism, both international and domestic. If you're driving your car while listening to this podcast, strap in, keep your eyes on the road, and get ready for a fascinating ride as we get the straight scoop from a leader of one of America's fastest growing political parties.
Jim, terrorism is a constant topic of discussion. How do we prevent it? How do we also find terrorists beforehand? And I'll give an example that rattled me personally. In San Bernardino, about a block or two away from where I had worked, even though it was for a short period of time, we had a terrorist attack. There was a couple that shot several people at a government facility, a local government facility. People before that, unfortunately, they were afraid to say anything about this couple for fear of being deemed bigoted before the attack, because they were asked about it after. And that also went along with the Obama administration's pushback against religious profiling. So how do we do two things? How do we address religious discrimination? But how do we find terrorists who may be strongly associated with an ideology, a religious ideology?
Well, I'll say one thing, Lloyd. You don't ask easy questions. This is a tough one, and it has to do, you know, really with human behavior. I mean, how do we know in advance whether someone is going to commit a heinous deed or an act of violence? Sometimes there are indicators that we should be able to see and act on, and sometimes there are none. And, you know, we have all kinds of examples of serial killers and others who people thought were perfectly upright, outstanding students, citizens, and yet they were, you know, they were murdering lots of people. So it's a question that's been around for the ages, I guess, in terms of trying to predict human behavior. But some of these acts of quote-unquote terrorism, and, you know, we have to define what we mean by terrorism. We have domestic terrorism, as you know, some of these mass shootings, and then right. we have terrorism that's politically motivated or ideologically motivated, that, you know, that comes in from inside or outside of the country. Sometimes there are some pretty clear indicators on social media that people identify after the fact, that perhaps we could see, should see, and should act on. At the same time, there are all kinds of issues about privacy that most Americans feel pretty strongly about, that they don't want to have government peering into everything they say and do. So, you know, where do we find the balance on that? Another area that we know can reap some good results is to pay more attention to our mental health facilities and screening abilities in this country. We do a poor job with mental health, and we especially do a poor job with these young people. So many of these shooters, unfortunately, are young white men. And we still haven't quite figured that all out. And one of the reasons is that we have cut, we have basically eliminated federal spending on any serious research that looks into the causes of some of this gun violence and the use of guns in this country, which is, you know, greater by a magnitude of any other nation on the planet. And so we have a lot of hypotheses about why these young men are motivated to pick up these weapons and kill, you know, anonymous strangers for some kind of grievance that they have. But the point I wanted to make there is that in almost every case, when we go back and look at their backgrounds, there were clues. There were people, adults in the school system or people in their neighborhood, or in some cases, even people in their families who knew this young person was troubled and had problems, and yet nobody addressed those with any kind of professional help. And as a result of that, that person, you know, inflicted tremendous harm and suffering on lots of people. So we should do a better job with mental health. The other thing that you mentioned as an example is that people are afraid sometimes to say something when they see something because they might be accused of being bigoted. And, you know, when you say someone's bigoted, that implies motivation, their motives for doing it. And sometimes it might be bigotry, but other cases it's just somebody trying to be a good citizen and saying, here's something that's suspicious or alarming, and I think the authorities ought to take a look at it. So I think we could all do a better job with that the mantra, if you see something, say something, because you could save a lot of lives. And if you hurt somebody's feelings a little bit, that's a small price to pay if you're actually saving lives. But there is no one simple universal answer to that. But I think mental health, paying more attention to social media, these red flag laws that they're talking about, looking for those clues that we have somebody who is mentally unbalanced and prone to violence. Those are all things that we can do a better job of as a society.
And would you say that, what would you say about researching this area, especially because, of course, we have rises in extremism. We have the KKK, Proud Boys, Antifa. We have Al-Qaeda and its derivatives. And we have a lot of guns, but we also have a lot of gun violence. What could we do in the area of research?
Well,
or have we already done the research?
No, we really haven't. We've got some sort of empirical evidence to look at some of the things that motivate people toward acts of violence in general, but I don't think we, as a nation, really understand why it is that the United States of America has so much violence related to guns. Now, I suspect part of it is historical, you know, this pioneer culture that created this country. And I grew up in a rural area, so, you know, I grew up hunting, and, you know, my grandfather had guns, and, you know, I have guns, and my kids. So it was a part of our national identity. Guns were tools that sportsmen used, and in some cases, ranchers and others used to protect their livestock from predators and that kind of thing. And that's the way it was for a long time. In fact, the NRA, when it first started, was a sporting organization. It provided firearm safety instruction and all kinds of things for young people who wanted to go into hunting and sporting activities using firearms. It has become something else far beyond that now. And most of its membership are not hunters. Many of them are urban city dwellers who want guns for a variety of reasons, some real and some hypothetical, like protection. Sometimes they really need it. Sometimes they don't. So there's lots of areas, I think, that we ought to be looking at, especially as it relates to using guns for violence versus all of these responsible gun owners who never act out any violent deed using a firearm. And let's get at, what is the difference? What is the difference between people who have owned guns all of their lives and have never thought about using them for violence? And in some cases, these are people who have committed violent acts, but they didn't use a gun for it. They maybe used their fist or they used something else. So I'm not saying those are easy answers to come up with, but I think they're answerable if you had serious research and dollars looking at it and looking at the profiles of people who do these things versus the ones who don't.
So my next question is going to be, and the answer might be, we need more research on that, and that's fine. But we do have several instances, they're very common, of the right to bear arms, having a gun actually ended up saving someone's life. Either a dad was able to save his kids or his wife, or someone was able to save a group of people. We still have, of course, the mass shootings are becoming much more common, pretty much weekly. Is there an area in the United States where the gun laws are being effectively implemented to the citizens' benefits? Or do we not have enough research to really say that yet?
Well, that's a good question, and I don't know that we have a lot of empirical evidence, Lloyd, but New York City has done a pretty decent job. Their crime rates have dropped dramatically, and they have pretty strict gun laws, especially in terms of carrying handguns. And they do what most people would call frisking, you know, on the streets. And they've dropped the crime rate considerably. I'm not sure that the gun laws are the only reason for that. There's been a gentrification of New York City because of the cost of living there, like a lot of other cities. So the socioeconomics of New York City itself have changed dramatically over the last 10 or 15 or 20 years. You have a lot of highly educated professional people who can afford to live there, and that by its nature drops your crime rate. I'm not saying white collar crime has dropped. Remember, we have Wall Street there, but the kind of violent crime that you think of as being street crime has dropped. The problem with having specific localities in the country with different gun laws and looking at them as either good or bad examples is that unless you have a uniform set of regulations and approaches to gun usage, what happens locally doesn't matter much. In other words, you can have a state with very strict background checks and requirements for ownership and use of guns. But if you have another state anywhere in the country, but especially one nearby, that doesn't have that set of laws, it's very easy for traffickers to move guns around, and that's what's happening across the country. So the countries that seem to have put in place, not states, but countries that seem to have put in place laws that have made a difference are places like Canada, Australia, and a lot of other countries that are somewhat analogous to us who have dramatically lower incidences of gun violence. So those are probably the better examples to look at and research in terms of comparisons than particular states or cities.
No, that's good. I like how you were able to answer that question thinking outside of the box, because I did kind of restrict it to in the United States. What I didn't think to ask is, how about outside the United States? So that's a really good approach. What are other countries doing that we could implement here, not just what are other states doing besides the state I live in? So that's great.
You've been listening to an interview with Jim Rex, the national chair of the Alliance Party. We will return after a short break.
The two-party system that we've got is broken.
The choices are awful. All we see is lies, cheating, deceit.
You could say it about both parties. Neither one really stands for anything except acquiring and exercising power.
The idea was to give the power to the people, or the people who've given the power away. And that's where the system broke.
Government and our political system was designed to be malleable, you know, not rigid, not ossified, not always gridlocked.
Absolute power does corrupt, absolutely, and that's why the founders set the system up to avoid having concentrated power in the executive and in the national branch.
The founding documents are the best, it's the best government so far that we've come up with. We're just not doing it.
You know, it's tribalism, basically. If you're not in my tribe, then you're a bad person. You could say the sky is blue, and I'm going to say, no, it's green.
I think it's right out of a 1930s era playbook where if you can divide people, make them feel like something's being taken from them, probably pays well for them to make sure that everybody's divided, because In essence, it keeps them in office, it keeps them in power, it keeps them employed.
The amount of money that's involved in politics, it is crazy.
And Obama's a smart guy, but not even he could, he wasn't going to do it either. And I was like, okay, that's it. If he can't do it, it's not going to happen, because that's when I knew that the lobbyists and the corporate interests, the outside private interests that really have a hand in making sure that our political system doesn't work, I knew that they had won. And I said, okay, third party is the way to go.
What I think we're trying to do here is to make systemic change. Yeah, we need the right people, but there's not any one person, any one charismatic personality that's going to bring about the change that we so desperately need in this country.
Our biggest goals are election reform.
Knock down those barriers that have been built in the ballot access game by the state governments.
Fixing the dark money.
Getting good health care out there.
We need more women. We need more minorities. We need more occupations and backgrounds.
We don't have set paradigms and beliefs. We just want to solve problems. So we're open books. We're data sensitive. We want data. We want to solve solutions that help the most people.
Let's forget about where we disagree. Let's start with where do we agree.
Let facts be facts and let truth be truth, and afford people the opportunity to go and find the information they need.
We require term limits of all of our candidates.
Now, if you have more choices and competition, just like any free market enterprise, competition is going to give you a better product.
Focus on innovation and really learning on a local level.
Free press and educating people in an unbiased way.
Protecting and controlling the deficit.
With respect and courtesy.
Honesty through transparency.
Openness and transparency.
Transparency. I think that's incredibly important in a number of areas, but especially in finances, so that voters can connect the dots.
We want to leave this place in a better condition than we left it for the next generations, pure and simple. Not just my children, all our American kids.
We need to educate every single individual in this country, so every individual has tools they need to succeed in life.
Ultimately, that's what we're doing this for, what we can help the American people be. Not what we say they can be, but what they want to be, and we'll get our party to that point.
We're supposed to help each other rise up, enlighten each other, and start by being civil and respecting other people's opinions.
There's nobody left. We have to do it.
There's right and there's wrong. Nobody owns it. You know, JFK, I believe, was quoted as saying something to the effect of, we don't need to look for the Republican answer or the Democratic answer. We need to look for the correct answer. And that's the types of conversations we're not having. As a people, are we doing what we should be doing?
We're back. We're talking with Jim Rex, the national chair of the Alliance Party. We've been discussing terrorism, both international and domestic. And we touched a bit on gun regulation. Now let's spend some time talking about all forms of discrimination and what we can do to build those emotional bridges we so desperately need to help keep our society together.
My next question is discrimination. It's a pretty big concern. The news is constantly informing us of incidences. How big an issue is it? Are there needs in America's many communities, whether it's ethnicity, sexual orientation, gender, age, or religion, that are not being adequately addressed? And could you address some of those?
Well, you know, discrimination is one of those things that if you're the discriminator, it seems like a minor issue. If you're the victim of discrimination, it is a major issue. And so in this country, we have lots of groups who feel, often with considerable justification, that they are being discriminated against. You mentioned some of them: sexual orientation, ethnicity, gender, age, certainly religion. You know, some people would say, if you're short, there are some people who discriminate against you. Some people would say, if you're obese, there are people who discriminate against you. You know, so there's always been, and to some extent, there always will be some discrimination, but it shouldn't be for an entire class or group of people. That's what is, you know, the worst example. And here again, you know, we have documents in this country that have tried to help us be better human beings around these issues, the Bill of Rights, but most religions too, the Golden Rule, I'm not a religious scholar, but I know enough about some of the great religions of the world to know that they have a couple of things in common. They all ask their followers to believe in their definition of God. And then the second most important rule for all these religions is, treat your neighbor as you want to be treated, a golden rule, as others, should be treated. So, some of it is something, some of it we can address through government and laws and regulation, but frankly, some of it is just, we've got to become better human beings and appeal to our better angels, all of us, and be more aware of the acts of discrimination that all of us are probably guilty of at different times, and oftentimes not intentionally. But if you're the victim of that discrimination, it's a very big deal. And sometimes it can have major consequences for that human being. So, what can I say? Families ought to be working on it. Schools ought to be working on it. Churches ought to be working on it. And yeah, government ought to have rules and laws that make it difficult to discriminate.
In light of the government, one of the bigger issues that gets a lot of attention is police discrimination. The flip side of that is there's also a tremendous mistrust of police in general, which prevents good officers from being able to help citizens. There's something I've heard of called community policing, but I'd have to research more myself. That sounds like a bridge, but what could be done in the area of police brutality on one side, police harassment, but on the other side, building relations of trust with police departments and police officers and not prejudging them as though they were always there just to harass you. What would be a good way to make a bridge there, prevent bad things from happening on both sides?
Well, I'm going to go back to politics again for a minute. Police officers are important public servants. And it's sort of like the military. It's sort of like first responders. Our elected officials all like to say how important they are, how important these people are, how they praise them in times of a disaster. But they pay them very poorly. They won't raise taxes to increase their benefits. And it makes it difficult to attract the quality of people we need, and certainly the quantity of the people we need in these important roles for our society. So you can start out by putting your money where your mouth is. If police officers are important to all of us for our safety and protection, let's treat them like the professionals they are. Let's pay them well. Let's train them well. And let's screen out those individuals who have no business, no proclivity for being in that kind of role. It's one thing to have somebody who's ill-suited for a particular job in terms of the damage that person can do in that occupation or that profession. But a police officer is a person with a weapon and almost a license to kill. A police officer is judged innocent until proven guilty when he or she uses their firearms against the defendant. And this goes back to your earlier question about discrimination. I'm a white male. I don't feel particularly threatened if I'm stopped by a police officer. Even if I'm driving at 2 a.m. and a highway patrolman pulls me over, my heart rate doesn't go up much. It does a little bit, but not worrying about my life being threatened. If I were a black teenage male, and especially in some cities and in some neighborhoods where a police officer or a pair of police officers pull me over, my heart rate would probably go up because I know what could happen and I know what the odds are that I would be, defended and exonerated if it came down to my word against a police officer. So we need the very best people in those roles, and they need to be trained. They need to be screened so we don't get, the wrong kind of person. We talked about discrimination and prejudice a minute ago. Definitely don't want those kinds of people in law enforcement if we can possibly avoid putting them in those roles. So
yeah,
that's where I'd start. That's where I'd start. there's no doubt that there's been abuses on the part of police, especially in minority communities. At the same time, it's a very difficult, demanding, dangerous job. They're underpaid and underappreciated. So, there should be sympathy on both sides of this equation. Here again, there ought to be a way for our elected officials to make the situation better, not worse. And oftentimes, they just wrap themselves around the badge and say they support all police officers, no matter what, you know, the circumstances are. And that's not the answer either.
Yeah, that's an important topic, and it's something that can be explored a lot more, and I think it's important to a lot of people. The next question I have is, what issues does the Alliance Party avoid? Which ones are not significant to the Alliance Party, and why?
Well, I don't think we avoid any of them, and you're probably giving your listeners a pretty good example of that tonight. Our job. And it's a job, is if you're an elected official, your job is to solve problems, make life better if you can for the majority of your constituents, and to represent those constituents. And so if it's an issue for your constituents or any of your constituents, it needs to be an issue for you as an elected official. So I can't think of any issue that we would not address or try to address. We address them differently depending upon what the issue is. I'll give you one quick example. There are some issues, you've touched on some tonight, where a particular elected official's constituency doesn't have agreement. They don't have a consensus around what should be done with that issue. Let's say it's abortion or the gun rights issue, immigration, whatever. There are some areas where there is consensus, depending on where the district is that elected official is representing, where the vast majority of people agree that we should address the topic or the problem in a certain way. In those districts, the elected official can represent that agreement, that consensus. That's their job. If they believe their constituents are wrong, the majority of them are wrong, they can always try to convince them otherwise. But until they do that, their job is to represent, those beliefs on the part of the constituents. However, when their constituents don't agree on an issue, what the solution is, we ask our elected officials to respond differently in those situations than what we see now from Republicans and Democrats. We ask them, first of all, do not use that issue for political gain. Do not divide your constituents even further by picking one side or the other, and then, lambasting the side you don't agree with or your base doesn't agree with as being evil or wrong. Secondly, we tell them under those circumstances, be honest with your constituents about what your personal position is about that issue. Just because everybody doesn't agree on it doesn't mean you can't be honest and say, here's where I stand on that issue at this moment, and here's my rationale. But you need to follow that by saying, we have to listen to every opinion about this issue, and we have to listen to it with civility and with openness and realize that everybody has a legitimate option to express their beliefs. And then the third thing we ask them to do as an elected official is to create as many venues as they possibly can for their constituents to come together and discuss that issue openly and forthrightly, hopefully with some facts also, about the issue, with an emphasis on looking for areas of agreement, not areas of disagreement. And I'll tell you, Lloyd, there's virtually no issue, and you haven't given one tonight, and I doubt you can come up with one. There's virtually no issue that if you sit people down and you ask them to be civil and listen to one another, where they won't find some areas of agreement around that issue. But you have to model that behavior yourself as an elected official if you expect your constituents to exhibit that behavior also. So that's what we're asking our people to do with those kinds of issues.
We've been listening to our interview with Jim Rex, the national chair of the Alliance Party. Unfortunately, we're out of time for this episode. Please stay tuned to the Alliance Party website for subsequent episodes in this interview series. Or better yet, subscribe to this podcast on iTunes, Google, or Spotify. All content for this podcast is copyright the Alliance Party. Views expressed in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the Alliance Party. This podcast is a production of the Alliance Party, a decades-long movement of fiscally conservative, moderate, and accountable and reasoned independents, former Democrats, former Republicans, and alienated voters who demand that our elected officials work in the spirit of nonpartisanship for all constituents and provide a better future for our country. This podcast was made possible by your donations to the Alliance Party. If you would like to help sponsor this podcast directly, get in touch with us through our website at thealliancepartycom. If you'd like to join the Alliance Party, visit our website at thealliancepartycom. Drop in, see what we're all about, and get involved. Volunteer your time. Make a donation, submit an article or blog, or run for office. We'd love to hear from you. I'm M. Lloyd Johnson, moderator of the Alliance Party After Dark, saying, have a wonderful evening. A great week ahead, and we hope you drop in for our next show. Be safe and be aware.